This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke is a smart guy, so we took the Fed at its word yesterday when it said the recession is leveling out. But based on the retail numbers that came out this morning, I'm not sure anybody told the American consumer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 13th of August. Glad you could be with us. There was much rejoicing yesterday after the Federal Reserve wrapped up its meeting on interest rates. A bull market in optimism, if you will, with the Fed's pronouncement that the recession is winding down. Today, consumers splashed that market smack in the face with a case of cold bucket of reality. Despite fatter paychecks from stimulus money and a boost from the Cash for Clunkers program, we learned this morning retail sales actually went backward last month. Marketplace's Amy Scott asked around. She found a lot of economists who were taken by surprise.
My gut reaction was, oh, no.
Jennifer Lee is an economist with BMO Capital Markets. She says people cut back on almost everything last month, from sporting goods to appliances.
Not that everyone was expecting anything hugely positive, but I guess the widespread weakness amongst all the sectors was very disappointing.
Another sign of weakness came from Walmart. The company says sales and revenue fell last quarter, though its profits held up thanks to cost-cutting. Auto sales did rise by almost 2.5%, but not as much as analysts had expected. The Cash for Clunkers rebate program kicked off in late July, so more of a bump may show up this month. But Joshua Shapiro at consulting firm MFR says interest in Cash for Clunkers is waning, and the program may be cutting into other retail sales.
If people are scrimping and saving to buy a car, and they're sort of just the $4,500 put them over the top to be able to afford it, odds are, yes, it does affect other spending.
You hear so much about consumption driving the economy. Can it turn around without the consumer's participation? Scott Hoyt with MoodysEconomy.com says yes, for a while.
They're not going to be the leaders of the economic recovery, particularly if it has started or if it's starting in the near future. It's going to have to be businesses and government that drive the near-term recovery.
Hoyt says the hope is once the recovery starts creating jobs and income, consumers will join the ride. Today's numbers are a reminder that it could be a slow and bumpy road along the way. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There is a Cash for Clunkers punchline to be had here, too. I don't know if you saw this item this morning, but now Russia is working on an auto trade-in program. 50,000 rubles, about $1,500, if you trade in something more than 10 years old. We went checking, and according to the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the average car in Russia is 10 years old. Staying on the other side of the Atlantic for a bit now, both France and Germany reported today that their economies grew last quarter. A 0.3% increase in gross domestic product isn't really much to celebrate, but Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us that people looking for signs the global recession is ending, well, they're going to take what they can get.
The news from France and Germany is good, but many economists remain cautious about the continent's economic outlook. Italy, Spain, and the UK are still mired in recession, and the downturn in Europe has been deep.
France and Germany and most of the Eurozone have had a dreadful few quarters, very, very sharp declines in economic activity.
Edward Haddis is an economist at Breaking Views, a website based in London. He was shocked today when France and Germany reported economic growth, but...
That doesn't necessarily mean that we're in the path for a full recovery. I think bouncing along the bottom is a more likely scenario.
Haddis thinks this growth may be the result of government stimuli. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel faces elections in September and pressures to keep voters happy. After the elections, Hattis fears the stimulus could be scaled back and the country's economy could start shrinking again. But Michael Moore, an economist at George Washington University, thinks there's good reason to be hopeful.
Germany's not alone. There's growth in China. There's some indication in the United States that things aren't as bad as they have been in recent periods.
And Germany's the world's largest exporter. So Moore believes it's already benefiting from the beginnings of a global recovery.
The growth that we've seen in this quarter is a reflection of increased export demand. And that means that the world as a whole is buying German goods.
Last quarter, German exports shot up 7%. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There was nothing at all shooting up on Wall Street today, more like bouncing around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know all those town hall meetings where people are protesting death panels and other things they have heard are going to be included in the healthcare overhaul? Turns out all the yelling is having a real effect on the debate and on policy, too. Today, the Senate Finance Committee decided end-of-life care is so politically touchy that it can't even be talked about, let alone be included in the final bill. Joel Rose reports.
A lot of the heat at the town hall meetings focused on a provision in the House's healthcare bill. It would encourage doctors to talk with their patients about the care they want at the end of their lives. For example, do they want to be put on life support, the kind of thing living wills spell out? But that got blown up into supposed death panels, first in an op-ed in the New York Post, later in comments by Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich.
The way it has been distorted into death panels and government bureaucrats deciding who should live or die is a complete fabrication.
Robert Berenson is a fellow at the Urban Institute. More than a quarter of all Medicare spending happens in the last year of patients' lives, much of it as they're dying. And Berenson says the government could save billions of dollars by reducing care that patients may not even want.
The savings would have nothing to do with anybody making a decision to deny some care that patients and their families want, but rather would be associated with honoring patients' own wishes.
Conversations about end-of-life care are often difficult for doctors to have, says Peter Pronovost at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He says the goal should be more dialogue between doctors and patients, not less.
We would like patients and their families to make the wisest decisions. There is information that has to inform that decision, and far too often, physicians don't provide it.
After a week where the political discourse was dominated by death panels, Pronovost says that goal seems more remote than ever. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
There is obviously a lot of information and misinformation flying around out there about health care reform. President Obama is trying to get back on top of the debate. He's doing a series of his own town hall meetings across the country this month, and he is getting a boost from a $12 million ad campaign that started airing this morning.
What does health insurance reform mean for you? It means you can't be denied coverage for a pre-existing condition or dropped if you get sick. It means putting health care decisions in the hands of you and your doctor. It means lower costs, a cap on out-of-pocket.
Chris Frates covers health care for Politico. Chris, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's go straight to the bottom of the screen on this ad, that line that comes at the end of all these political ads that say paid for by, in this case, paid for by Americans for Stable Quality Care. Who are these guys?
Well, these are a group of industry and consumer groups that have gotten together to pump President Obama and the Democrats' push for health care reform. They're the pharmaceutical industry. They are Families USA. They're a healthcare consumer group, nationally respected. You have the Federation of American Hospitals and SEIU, the Service Employees Union.
The phrase strange bedfellows comes to mind.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of why this buy is so important, because it combines the unions and the industry as well as consumers to say we are pushing for healthcare reform at a time when President Obama is on the defensive for his reform efforts.
Who are these ads aiming at, though?
Well, these ads are aiming at folks who are getting the messages all over the media that Americans are opposed to health care reform. And what they are trying to do is to convince Americans that there are items in healthcare reform that are good for them. They're trying to sell them on why they should be for reform, that they won't be denied coverage for things like pre-existing conditions, that they'll have access to the healthcare that they need even if they were to lose their jobs, because proponents of healthcare reform feel like if they could get their message out above the roar of the town halls that we've had so far this August, then people would get behind the effort because there's so much in reform for them.
Well, let's talk about that roar for a minute. It's fairly substantial. Can these ads and this buy, no matter how big it is, really push through?
I think that is the hope of supporters, that with these ads, which comes with a substantially deep-pocketed group, the pharmaceutical industry has said that they are willing to put almost $150 million toward reform ads. So they believe that if they could saturate the airwaves with these pro messages, that eventually people would begin to see that there's a lot of sizzle but no steak behind this opposition. But as you point out, it is very loud. All the media coverage now is about the conflict and the confrontations. They're trying to rise above that and give the president some air cover as he goes around and tries to make the case to the American people.
Do we know who is outspending who in these ad wars, the pro-reform side or the con side?
Right now, we do know that about $51 million has been spent so far on healthcare reform ads. The bulk of those ads have been generically for reform. So they say we need healthcare reform now, but they don't get behind any one plan or another, which is why this buy is so significant, because it's a substantial investment in getting behind the Democratic plans now pending in Congress.
Chris Frates, he covers healthcare for Politico. Chris, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
As state and local governments have cut back on services in the face of this recession, small businesses and property owners have largely been left to fend for themselves. One way they're doing that is by picking up on the concept of business improvement districts, where those businesses tax themselves to pay for things like extra security and landscaping. Making sure districts get the right name, though, is an important first step, as Mina Kim found out in a mostly African-American neighborhood in Oakland, California.
Ever since this stretch of Telegraph Avenue became a business district, it's seen a lot of positive change. Freshly painted storefronts, trash-free sidewalks. But when bright blue and orange banners were installed recently touting its name, it upset some of the locals. That's because the banners declared the district Koreatown, and they have a tagline that says, "Oakland's got Seoul." Only Seoul is spelled S-E-O-U-L.
The initial reaction was one of just being offended and feeling disenfranchised.
Akila Zainabu is a notary and graphic artist here.
This area is majority black, but we didn't never decide to say, okay, this is Africa Village. No. Koreatown played the race card by putting up banners that say Koreatown Northgate. It doesn't include anybody else that's here.
There are clusters of Korean businesses, but they make up less than 20%. Now Zainabu and others are circulating a petition to bring the banners down. But Alex Han says the name is needed to lure more business here. Han is president of the business district's board.
If we call Koreatown, a lot of Koreans are going to invest here.
Han says Koreans associate the name with success after a booming Koreatown in Los Angeles, and already a Korean hotel company and supermarket chain are interested in the neighborhood. Han is often credited for being the visionary of the district. The extra tax paid by property owners generates about $280,000 a year for things like removing graffiti, sweeping streets, and adding police patrols.
Somebody has to do something, make sure this place better to business. We've done it. And why don't you give us a chance?
One person who's been willing to give them a chance from the get-go is Jermel Davenport.
I feel what Koreatown is doing is an excellent thing because they're bringing revenue. They're trying to find ways to make it really nice for everyone.
Davenport's a dialysis technician who's lived here for 8 years. When property owners started organizing, he went to their meetings. Davenport was vocal and engaged. The Koreatown board soon realized his involvement could help prevent racial tensions. So the group hired Davenport to be its official neighborhood ambassador. It's a part-time paid position.
Hey, buddy, how are you today, man?
On a walk through the district, Davenport chats up the owner of a dry cleaning shop. Before the banners went up, Davenport invited residents to discuss them at community meetings. Though he understands the resentment, he says in these tight times, people should care more about their businesses than what's written on a banner.
It just gives the area
or articular name, but it doesn't take away what it really is.
The Koreatown Board is hosting a street festival in September to showcase the neighborhood's diversity. Davenport says a barbecue cook-off will be part of the fun.
No matter if it's Korean, whether you're Hispanic, whether you're white, if you can barbecue and you know your food is good, well, come on out.
Davenport hopes outreach like this will help end the flap over the Koreatown banners. In Oakland, I'm Mina Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, with Disney in the past, Michael Eisner looks to the future.
Eventually, there'll be something on the internet that's a cultural phenomenon that's not available anywhere else, and the world will find it.
A conversation from a much smaller corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials inched up 0.3% today, 36 points, 9,398 at the close. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.5%, 10 points, finished at 2009. The S&P 500 rose 0.2%. That works out to 6 points, ended at 1,012. Investors decided all that cost-cutting by Walmart it made it worth buying today. The retailer rang up a gain of 0.2% today. Bank of America pushed up more than 6.5% after a big hedge fund bought a boatload of that bank stock. That also helped lift J.P. Morgan 1.6%, charged up Wells Fargo, rather, 2.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.6%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for July. Danielle Steele turns 62. More than 580 million copies of her books are in print. That's a lot of drama. And on August 14, 1935, President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Gainesville, Florida sits right in the heart of the Sunshine State. It's probably best known for its powerhouse college football team, the University of Florida Gators. The city has also started attracting attention for power of a different sort, though. Solar energy panels are popping up all over the city, and so are the economic benefits. Jennifer Collins has more now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Gary Rowell owns a tire shop in Gainesville. And this is what he thinks about climate change.
I don't believe in global warming to 100%. I think it's mostly bull.
That said, Raul has installed two sets of solar panels, one on his house and one on his shop. He's even running ads on local radio because, despite his doubts about global warming, Raul wants to let customers know he's gone green.
We're extremely proud of a sizable investment just installed here at our shop. You won't notice anything different when you drive up, but there are 144 solar panels on our roof now.
The system costs more than $200,000 to install, but Raul expects to get that money back and more. That's because this spring, Gainesville adopted a solar incentive program that's the first of its kind in this country. Over the next 20 years, the city-owned utility will pay Rowell and others who put up solar panels for all of the power they generate. And it'll pay well, about three times the current retail rate for electricity. For Rowell, that adds up to $18,000 a year. Gainesville designed the program with this question in mind.
What does the payment have to be to make it a good investment for the owner?
Ed Regan heads the program for Gainesville's utility. He says in most of the country, people who put up solar panels don't have the option of selling their power back to the grid. And if they do, they typically get far less than the retail rate in return. Gainesville's paying for this incentive program by increasing utility bills, about $10 a year. It's all part of the city's plan to get 20% of its power from renewable energy in the next 5 years. To see how the program's working, Regan only has to head out onto his office balcony.
You see that, like, flat, shiny thing with those kind of square-looking things? That's a 75-kilowatt solar array up there. Right behind these trees, there's a bunch of those buildings over there, another 100 kilowatts.
Regan's looking at enough solar panels to run about 35 homes. And as new ones come online this year, that figure will jump to 800 homes. That's got solar installation companies in town scrambling.
Watch that edge there, guys.
Wayne Irwin owns Pure Energy Solar. He and his crew are at a ranch house in Gainesville installing a 3-kilowatt solar array. That system should provide about half the home's energy needs. Right now, Gainesville Solar Incentive Program has at least a 5-year waiting list. But Irwin says the program has sparked so much interest in solar that some folks who don't want to wait in line are buying panels anyway just to save on their electric bill.
There's no question as to whether or not it'll pay back. With all the incentives that are available today in Florida, it's possible to realize your return on investment in the first year, and then everything after that's gravy.
Thanks to that gravy, Irwin expects his workload to quadruple this year. He's already talking to Gary Rowell about installing a third set of panels. Rowell's motivation?
I got 5 grandkids, and I said, you know what? I'm going to do it for them if I do nothing else.
As it is, Rowell expects to earn $300,000 over the next 20 years. And he wants that money to be there when those grandkids head off to college. In Gainesville, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Michael Eisner spent 20 years turning the Walt Disney Company into the multi-billion dollar media conglomerate it is today. 20 often uneasy years, it has to be said, especially at the end, when shareholder protests made his decision to step down somewhat less difficult. After Eisner left Disney in 2005, he started a small media company of his own called Tornante. That's Italian for hairpin turn, and it might just as easily describe his new career.
The boss will see you now.
Instead of movies and Mickey Mouse, Michael Eisner is now focused on making sports videos for kids and re-energizing Topps baseball cards. Next week, he gets back into television with a new show, Glenn Martin DDS is the title. It's an animated series about a dentist taking his family on the road to see the country. But more than anything else, Eisner is trying to capitalize on the internet. He's experimenting with scripted shows that run only online, and he has had some critical success, but he's not really making much money.
In the scope of things, it's in its infancy, and advertisers haven't completely come there other than in search. Generally, incorrectly, people think that America and the world has got ADD and can only watch something that's 2.5 minutes long. They only watch something that's 2.5 minutes long because that's all anybody's been able to make is any good. If you give them quality content, eventually the audience will be there. Eventually there'll be something on the internet that's a cultural phenomenon that's not available anywhere else, and the world will find it.
Do you ever wish you had left Disney earlier to get started working on the web?
Well, it's not that I thought about wish I left earlier to work on the web, but in hindsight, I'm glad I left when I did, although if I left 5 or 6 years earlier, I would have a longer span to get back into the content business. We got so big at Disney, and there were so many issues of a conglomerate that I couldn't really do what I found is my only ability. You know, I can read a balance sheet, but not that great. I can host the board meeting, I guess, as well as anybody else, but boringly. But content I have more interest in. So I'm glad I've back to that. being in a board meeting and seeing one more flip card presentation or one more return on equity or one more conversation about financial endeavors is less interesting to me than finding out what's funny about a dog on Glenn Martin DDS. That's a failing probably, but I just am more interested in that dog than I am in the dog of finance.
Are you surprised then that you were at Disney as long as you were?
No, because we had a, you know, we had a great run. Disney is a fantastic company. All the people that I was associated with and brought in Disney are still there. But I don't have the responsibility of 120,000 employees right now, which is okay. I can actually turn my BlackBerry off for this interview and not think how many people would like to be driving me crazy. I'm not that worried about analysts. I'm in a private company. So it's a different life, although I'm just as obsessed as ever, so I guess it's not that different.
Does your experience at Disney as a classic old media guy, movies, televisions, theme parks, does that help you or hurt you as you try to get your creative ideas into the new media, into the internet?
I'm not sure I was a typical head of a company like that. One of the problems with Disney, I'm told, was that everybody said from 1966 to 1984, what would Walt have done? And when I was asked what would Walt have done, I would say, I have no idea. I've seen these great movies. I know I know a lot about him. Obviously, I read everything about him. I'd never met him. I interviewed all the people at Disney that knew him. But I never thought what Walt would have done. I thought what we would have done. I knew that I was nowhere near as talented as Walt. And one of the problems was, I don't know if the company, before I got there, recognized that Walt wasn't there. So what I did was went and hired 20 people that together added up to one Walt. And, you know, we had Steven Spielberg and George Lucas working with us in the beginning. And then we started bringing Bob Zemeckis, and we started bringing in a lot of people in the industry that added up to a Walt. So time moves on.
Michael Eisner, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
To hear Michael Eisner's thoughts about turning his web series Prom Queen into a musical, believe it or not, head to our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can check out the whole archive of our series, Conversations from the Corner Office.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that I can die now because I have officially seen everything, Google is worried about cost-cutting. The company has canceled the party it throws every year at a big search engine confab up in Silicon Valley, 15,000 software engineers. A Google spokesman said only that they have been looking carefully at their expenses, the company has. And a word about the music on the program today. Everything you heard was by guitar legend Les Paul, the man who basically invented the electric guitar and, with it, rock and roll, one could argue, died today. Les Paul was 94 years old. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow added 36 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ rose 10 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 6 points. That is 0.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, the cash behind commemorations.
Basically, any calendar day of the year that you pick, there's some day that commemorates it. You know, there's National Denim Day, you know, National Ice Cream Month, something that somebody can go out to use to sell an ad to someone.
What's tomorrow? We'll tell you, but you got to listen. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.